I think it would be appropriate for, first of all, me to continue on as I have been in telling you about the reactions and so forth of this week. First of all, I'll talk about my general feelings, and that is that tomorrow we'll be completing the 12th week. And you remember back at the 8th week, I entitled that The Magic of the 8th Week and said that I was looking forward to the 12th week because there is supposed to be a change take place along about that particular time. And I feel that there has been. It's not as much as it was in the 8th week. It's not so drastic. It's kind of hard to explain, but yet there has been a significant improvement in what has happened to me in the last couple of weeks. And so what I have written down here is that much better, more confident, more steady, more self-esteem, more hope of the future, more in control, both publicly and at home. Just in every way, I feel that I have improved tremendously in the last 7 days, and especially in the last 14 days. I think that I am accepting her death more all of the time. I find that I'm going over the details of her life and her death much less, and I don't feel the need to know everything about her death. Now, I really haven't talked about that, I don't think, up to this time, but up to about this particular time, she has been on my mind every minute of the day. And the thing that you do is that you just mull it over and you go over it and over it and over it and over it and over it 1,000 times, 2,000 times, 10,000 times. I don't know how many thousands of times that you go over things. And I've had this a tremendous desire to know everything about how she died. The autopsy report gives you a scientific explanation. I've got the dictionary and looked up all the words and got somewhat of an idea, but I felt a burning need to make an appointment with a doctor and go ask him exactly what happened and what caused her to die. Was it this artery or was it this artery? And if she'd have lived, what would have happened if she'd been on this medicine and on that? And you just wrestle with it and wrestle with it. And so I put it off and said, I'm not going to write him and bother him until I get more in control of myself so that I can ask some sensible questions and will not bother him that much. I can break it down and there might be two or three things that I'll want to know. This week, I feel like I probably won't be writing him. I won't be calling him to talk about it. I feel like that I'm getting it in control and I'm accepting a little bit more. Now, when you talk about accepting her death, it's the 12th week now, and I am, when we look at the charts, I can show you a little bit better here about where I think I am. I am in the middle of accepting the fact that she's gone and she won't come back. Not all the way, as you can tell. This is just an indication. I can't say she'll never come back without having an emotional reaction, which shows that I'm not there yet. This past Monday, when I picked up the Kirkland paper, I read about the 124th Totem Lake Interchange. They're planning on improving that. The first thing that came to my mind, oh, she'll be so happy, and no, she's not here. So I'll tell her when I see her, and it's so that when I die, that'll be one of the first things I want to tell her. Honey, they fixed up that mess up at Totem Lake, then I sat down and thought, man, what I'm getting ready to see when I get there, I won't be worried about Totem Lake either. But I just use it as a thermometer. I'm not there yet, but I'm a whole lot closer than what I was, is what I'm saying. And in the last couple of weeks, why I've gained a whole lot along that line. As I am going into this accepting, it's rather interesting. You think, well, when you get into the acceptance, all of the studies show that you have to do that before you can really have a recovery. And you look forward and you think everything then must be pretty nice. But everything has its drawbacks. And that is, as I find that I am accepting it more, for instance, when I drive home, I don't have to talk to myself all the way home and prepare myself that she's not there. I can, you know, think about it once or twice. I know she's not there. It used to be when I drive up in the driveway, I'd look for a light to just see maybe an extra light's on, even though you don't know it. I'm not doing that anymore. But as you can see, I'm halfway in between. But now when I don't, and I accept it, and when I don't look for that, there's a lightness that hits my stomach. Just a it's a physical reaction. Just makes you feel kind of sick at your stomach that you're saying, I know she's gone. She's not coming back. It's a reaction that I didn't know that would be there. But anyway, what I've got down here, I've gone a long way in doing so, and because of the feelings that I have when I think about her being alone, it's more real, it's more lonesome. I'm here alone. Now what will I do? And goddamn, I give myself more pep talks. I kick myself more when I feel sorry for myself. I realize that healing hurts, and I'm healing. I may be in that stage. I don't know. You might put a pep talk stage in there. I don't know what you do. As you go along, you constantly have to talk to yourself and make yourself do certain things. Telling Roy that a couple evenings ago, about 4 o'clock, I was walking out getting the mail and kind of feeling sorry for myself, thinking, well, I've got a couple hours now before class starts and nowhere to go and nobody to call. I'm thinking about her and thinking how long will this go? If I live another 30 years, do I have 30 years to spend every evening here in this office, 30 times 365 and take a Saturday and a Sunday off, you know? And you get to thinking like that, and so then I give myself pep talks. I say, well, fella, you could have had it if you'd have died 10 years ago. You certainly wouldn't have been here in the office. You'd have been running home to your kids, trying to take care of your children, and trying to get a babysitter so you could get back in and teach. And which would you rather have? And all of a sudden, I got pretty happy that you can kick yourself in the seat of the pants. That's what I mean. When you do get to feeling sorry for yourself, and you do feel sorry for yourself. Another thing that is hitting me right now is I'm beginning to realize the magnitude of her influence, of how much she was really appreciated, and how much good she's done at her death, how much she's helped me, how much she's affected both myself and others, so that I could almost say that really I've already, in these past 3 months, done about as much good as I feel that I've done in the past 2 years. It's just been awesome, the amount of influence, the amount of good that has come from her death across the country, of people that I've had the opportunity of talking to and talking with in their marital problems, in other problems, in bringing people back to the Lord, in just so many ways. I found that I've been able to deal with people somehow on a different level and accomplishing maybe in 10 minutes what it would take me 10 hours before this to actually accomplish. And it's because of her influence. And I just can't, I still can't realize it. And yet I am in the process now of realizing the magnitude of that. That's another thing I like to tell her. She didn't know that she had that at all. I'm beginning to realize how much people love me. Up to this time, I really haven't. As you told me, we love you and so forth, I like to hear it. But it was going kind of into a, I guess I felt more like a peanut hull without any peanuts in it up until the last week or two. It just there's nothing there. There's no value in me whatsoever. I have nothing to offer to anybody, including my children, my friends, the Lord, anybody else. I could kick myself and say, now you've got to get busy and teach, and I'd go down and teach. But I'm talking about the feelings. I'm not talking about the intellect. that you just feel like a hull is the way it is. And what good is a peanut hull? I mean, stop to think, what do you do with a peanut hull? Only thing I do with them is set and eat the peanuts out and throw them away. And if one falls on the rug, I don't pick it up, except it makes me mad, it's in my way, and so I pick it up and throw it away. But if it's got a peanut in it, I'll pick it up and eat it. Well, that's the way I felt. It was just in that way. That feeling is starting to leave. I'm getting more self-esteem. Beginning to understand that people do love me. And you can say, well, you're crazy for never understanding it. Again, the purpose of this class is not to tell you whether I'm right or wrong. It's just to tell you how you're going to feel. That's all that it is. It's just that total empty feeling of that happening. And I realize how much now. I probably don't, but it's unbelievable. And what I do know of people, the letters that have been written to me and expressions that have been said and so forth, it just boggles my mind. One man told me last night, he's not from here, but he said that the night I'd made the statement that I'd just give anything to be able to talk to her for an hour, he said he went home that night and said he was praying. He said he prayed, Lord, said, please take me and just send her back for 1 hour. He said, I'll die if you just give her back for 1 hour so we can talk to her. Well, that's love. I mean, I realize that. And others have expressed a love that I can't comprehend, and I appreciate all of it. So I'm starting to get that feeling back, which is a good feeling this particular week. Now, I am scared, as I've told you. There's always a fear that pervades everything. And the fear is what will happen next month. In other words, I go in depression, what happens? Do you have relapses? She was my self-esteem builder, I guess you'd put it that way. I depended on her for that. Somewhere down here, I don't see it right now, I've got down here that, going to get it out of order, I suppose, but that if whatever she said, I really took it at face value. And what she thought of me, I accepted at face value. And I realized that, you know, that other people will say nice things to you, and there is such a thing as flattery. And so I don't take it too seriously. But what she said, I did. And so she was the tire pump that kept me pumped up. And it is a scary thing. What happens tomorrow? The next point, I feel myself getting better, and as I feel myself getting better, there's a fear of getting better. Now, this again is something that everybody has, and if you know it's there, it's very easy to get over. I'm not really having a problem with this. But there is an inward feeling of fear in getting over. Now, there's two things that hit you. And first of all, if I get over this in the next couple of weeks, which I won't, but if I make some good progress and if I could get back to normal in the next couple of weeks, what will it be like? It's going to be like a new world. I'm not sure I'm ready for it. It scares me out there. And you say, well, you know what it's like to live in a normal, happy world. No. No, I know what it's like to live with Doris in a normal, happy world. I don't know what it's like to live without her in a normal, happy world. I don't know what it's like to live without a wedding ring on. I don't know what it's like to live without a wife. I don't know what it's like. And it's scary to think about that. Well, you say, it ought to be nice. I know it, and I'm going to try. I'm just saying, it is an inward fear. You have to talk to yourself about it. And if you don't talk to yourself about it, you will not work trying to get better. In other words, you'll try to stay in that particular condition. Now, another thing that you've got down here that, right, if I get over it this fast, what will people think? Will they think that I really didn't love her? You know, if you can get over it and go out and joke and smile and laugh and so forth, the feelings are that I loved her so much that maybe I ought to cry for about 10 years. You know, I owe it to her. in there. Now, again, this is a very major problem in the healing process in the books that I read of people that have this feeling, and especially of women, I think, that they're afraid that people will feel that they really didn't love their husband or their wife if they respond too quickly and get over it too fast. Well, I've just made up my mind to one thing, and that is that I've lived with her for 32 years. 25 of those years have been here in front of the people at Kirkland. And if my actions toward her for 25 years and hers toward me doesn't prove I love her, then 2 years of crying is not going to help that person. And so I made up my mind, I'm going to get over it. I'm going to get over it as far as I possibly can. I'm going to heal as quickly as possible, and in doing so, I will be honoring her because that's what she had confidence that I would do. And I merely bring that up because in the books I read, it seems to be the prevailing problem that everybody has, and it hit me, I feel the same way. But it's one of those things that intellectually that you can get over. Now when we get down to specifics, you say, what's happened to you this past week? First of all, I've lost my notebook. So a lot of things I wrote down, I don't know. I don't know where the book is. I can't find it. And so maybe I'll retrieve it some of these days, but I don't know where it is. So some of those things are lost. But as I've got down here, there really isn't too much of a report this week because it's been more stable. The whole week has been pretty stable. Plus, I lost the notes, and there's some things in there I'm sure that I had written down that I would have talked about. But if I've had a stable week, a good, solid, stable week, it has been this week. It's been a very pleasant week. Tuesday and Wednesday, I did not break down and cry very heavily. I did cry both days, but it was only briefly and not very hard. And the same has been true today, of the same way. Another thing might sound funny, and that's the weather. The weather has been a blessing. Now, I well remember back when she died that this was one of the things I was dreading was springtime. And I would look out, and I really didn't want any sunny days. I thought, I really don't want any pretty weather from here on the rest of my life as long as I live. I don't want any pretty weather. If there's a pretty day, I feel good in pretty weather. And I'll be going out and feel good and she's not with me. And I'll be enjoying it without her. And you feel like you're cheating her. And so I hope it rains every day the rest of my life. That's the way I felt. And I was dreading spring. Oh, I was dreading spring when the buds start coming out and all the beauty, because every spring we'd drive along, we'd look at all the buds and we'd talk about them. But as I told you before, everything you think is going to happen turns around the other way. It's not that way. And this is another one of those things to show you how badly I've been wrong. It's been a blessing. We've had beautiful weather really ever since she died. The kind of weather I dearly love, today, beautiful. And now I look forward to spring. I really am looking forward to it. I'm looking forward to beautiful weather and long days and I thank God for giving me what I didn't want back there. So just lots of little things that you don't think about. In other words, had somebody come to me before she died and said, Lowell, write down all the things that you think will give you some problems. You could see my list. You could throw it away. And I wouldn't even thought about weather. But you do think about weather and all of those things when it happens. This past Tuesday was the first day I ate three meals. And I really didn't want them, but some companions forced it on me. But at least I did. And that afternoon, Tuesday afternoon, I guess it was. What is it? It was yesterday afternoon you came by, wasn't it, Roy? Roy came by and picked me up and wanted to go out to do some little thing, and we spent the entire afternoon talking about her. And that was a relief. It always is a relief to be able to sit down and talk. Again, I want to emphasize it 10,000 times if you need to know it. Because there's two dangers in this thing. Go ahead and get there, Brian. There's two dangers in this thing. When it happens, you want to try to hold yourself together as much as you can. You try to do that because of personal pride. You don't want to bother your friends because you know that it's hard on them. And so you try to hold it in. And then there are some unfortunate people that do not have any friends that they're able to talk to. But even if you have friends, you try to hold it in. And I want to urge you to that all studies show, and I can testify to this, that the quicker you begin grieving and the harder you grieve and the more you talk about it, the quicker you're going to heal. It's just that simple. And you say, well, I don't want to do that. Fine. Then go ahead and spend 10 years, you see, trying to accomplish what somebody else can do in a matter of a few months. It's one of those things that all studies show that is the fact of the case. So, again, what I'm going to do, every friend that I get that will tolerate it and so forth, well, I'll bend their ear and trying to heal myself. And I appreciate that. And it's something that, as a friend, that you need to realize that you can really help people in that way. The next thing is that last Sunday, as all of you know, I preached my first sermon. And when I stepped down from the pulpit, I felt like I could have floated out of here. I felt like that there was at least 20 tons off of my shoulders when I did that. I made the announcement briefly that I didn't know how to start the sermon and all of that. But I'll emphasize it in this class, that even though I've been preaching all these years, I literally did not know how to start that sermon. Larry, the past few weeks, would come in and say, you want me to preach for you Sunday, or are you going to try? And I'd say, well, I'll tell you Thursday. I'll see what happens this next week, and I'll tell you Thursday. Thursday came, I'd say, you preach, Larry. And we'd talk about it, and he was wondering, you know, how I felt. I said, I can't even tell you how I feel. I just don't know. When it comes to preaching that sermon, I don't even know how to start. I'm just totally lost. You just as well tell me to go to Mars and preach to a Martian, you know, up there. I do not know how to write the first sentence on there. Whatever I do will be wrong. See, that was my feelings. Just whatever I do would be wrong. And so I'd really set a time schedule for myself, not in weeks. I didn't say it will be the 11th week you'll preach. What I said was that at the very earliest moment that you feel that you can accomplish it, you will do it. And each week I went by examining myself, do you think that you can possibly do it? And so it wasn't until last week that I really felt, yeah, I could do it. That's the reason I had Brett to make that announcement. It wasn't for you. It was for me. It was to commit myself. I told him, Brett, make the announcement. I'll be preaching next Sunday. And when I told him that, the previous Sunday, I had not the slightest idea what I would say. I didn't know whether I'd preach on Acts 2:38 or what I would say. So Monday morning, I came in, sat down at the typewriter, and I remember saying, okay, buddy, it's up to you. And you're on your own, kind of like flying solo for the first time in an airplane. And put my hands on the typewriter. I knew I had to type out pretty closely what I was going to say, and just begin to let my fingers do the talking. I mean, just, okay, what would you like to say? What is on your mind? What would you like to say? And surprisingly enough, as I sat there and just kind of beat the typewriter without thinking very much, just what is on your mind? What do you want to say? The sermon turned out pretty well the way it was in the first draft. I didn't change, I really don't think I changed anything in going through it. Added a few scriptures and so forth. But finally then, put it down. Yeah, that is what I want to say. One little thing to show you how much a word can mean to somebody, and those of you in Acts, we talked about that this week, about the power that there is in somebody's influence. Doris Powell came back at the back, and she doesn't even know this yet, but really, she came back and she told me, she said she appreciated what I said, and she looked at me and she said, "And Doris would have really been proud of you." And I've lived on that statement all week. She'll never know, and neither will anybody else, what that statement meant to me. And my attitude really has been, as I mentioned a while ago, that I would get up and preach, and very seldom did Doris ever know what I was going to say. Once in a while, she would ask, you know, "What are you going to preach on Sunday?" And it became more that way in the last year or so. She became more interested. What are you planning on preaching on Sunday or something? Then it would get so that on Friday, I'd go home and I'd say, "Well, we've got her all worked in shape here and ready to go, and we can go out in the morning and have breakfast or do something." She'd say, "What are you going to preach on?" And I'd joke with her. I'd say, "You'll know Sunday morning when I get up." If I didn't want to talk about it, that satisfied her. It didn't make any difference. But she was interested in the last few months of her life, more so than any other. Well, what I'm getting at is that very, very seldom in her life did she know what I was going to preach when I got up on Sunday. But I was always interested in her reactions to what I said. And regardless of the comments that I would get from anyone else, whether they were good or whether they were bad, on the way home, somehow I would ask her a question to find out what she thought. You know, was it okay? Did it pass? And if she said, "Yeah," you know, said, "I approve that. That was a good lesson," then it really didn't make any difference what anybody else said about it. If I thought that's what I ought to say and she approved of it, then it was right as far as I was concerned. When you look at it in that way, of course, I was tremendously concerned about the lesson. Would I go overboard either way? And when she came back and said that, "Doris, you made my week. I've lived on it every day that in that way." Each week, we've been bringing up some humorous things. What's happened to you? Well, as I looked at some things I scratched out after I lost my notes 2 or 3 days ago, I wrote some things on the back of an envelope. Looked at it today, and on there, why, all it says was, number one, Bible, long example. And I totally forgot what I meant by that, so I'm not going to tell you. In other words, if I just put in a note, I have no idea. And the only thing I'm doing is just telling you that I was shocked when I looked down today and said, "I can't even read my own note, can't remember," you see, what it was that I was doing. Wednesday, now it's going to be embarrassing, and maybe we ought to cut this out of the tape. Wednesday, that's yesterday, I was going to be teaching on Philemon last night in Acts class, and so I wanted to scan it over there and look at a verse. And so I picked up my New Testament and flipped over. Okay, I'm going to look over here at Philemon. And I flipped, and where is Philemon? And it hit me, and it's in the New Testament. And I had my New Testament. See, it's in the New Testament. Front of the back. I think it's back by Hebrews. Yeah, it's back there. And I flipped back, and I couldn't remember where it was. So I hit Hebrews, and I look at the end of it, and I go over there, and there's James. Well, maybe it's the front, and I go to the front, and there's Philemon. So I read it. But it just gives you an illustration. I've lived by that book every day for 32 years. What would make an individual pick it up and all of a sudden forget where Philemon is? I did. The next point is that this past week, I was feeling so much better this past week. I've really made a lot of progress the past week. I've really been happy with myself because I thought I was working on the 11th week. So this week, I've been bragging on myself. Now, Deb Gerke and I don't mind bragging on ourselves. So I was patting myself on the back. I said, "Lowell, if you're doing this well in the 11th week, think what you do in the 12th week, when everybody says that is a good week. Boy, at the end of the 12th week, you're going to be so far ahead of the other common people, you know, that they're just no comparison." And so I got back, and yesterday I looked at the calendar again, and it says 12. And I got to counting it, and sure enough, I'm finishing the 12th week, so I'm not so great after all. Right along, really, with everybody else. Really, as I said, this week has not been a week of telling a lot of things because I have been very stable this week. It's been a wonderful week. I'm going to take just a little time before we go into some of these other statements here to then to say some other things that I'd like to say. Some people have asked me, what was Doris like? What do you think of when you think of her as a wife? Now, we're not going to spend a long period of time tonight on this. We could spend a whole hour and a half on it. But what are some words? And so this afternoon I just typed some words that I think of when I think of her. First of all is loyal. She was loyal to whatever cause she espoused. When I met her, she was a Christian. I told you how I met her and how that there was never a time, never a time when I was going with her, when I was dating her, never a time that it dawned on her that she might go my route instead of me going her route. I mean, it never entered her mind. And I don't know of anything that she wasn't loyal about. I think I've told you, wasn't it this class was I was telling you about, she's even loyal to the Cowboys, or was it somebody else that I was telling? I didn't tell it in here? Well, just to illustrate, she'd come in, she'd watch football with me. She didn't particularly care about it, but she'd watch it. And so this past couple of years, while I've been telling her, I said, now, honey, we've been up here so many years that now I want you to give Texas up. I want you to renounce Texas. I mean, you're a full-blooded Washingtonian, and I don't even want the word mentioned and so forth around the house anymore. She said, well, I'm not going to do it. Texas gave me my birth. And I said, I know it did, but that's enough. I brought you to Washington, and it's all over. And I knew I could rile her up a little bit and have a little conversation in the evening, you see. Well, I'm not going to do that. Yeah, you're going to do that. I'm not either. Well, sure you are. I'm your husband. I'm telling you you're going to do it. Well, I'm not, you know. So I dropped the subject, and next week, you know, we'd talk about it, and I'd rib her, and I'd tease her, and so forth. And finally, this past year, why I told her, I said, now, another thing, I've been telling you you're going to have to give Texas up. Now, another thing, this year, the Cowboys are so lousy that we're going to renounce them. We've rooted for them, you know, and you're not going to be a Cowboy fan anymore. I am too. No, you're not. I am too. No, you're not. I said, there's not going to be any Cowboy fans in here. And then she just kind of looked straight ahead and wouldn't say anything, and I gouged her a little bit more. And finally, I hit her sore spot. And she looked over, she said, honey, she said, let me tell you something. She said, I am not going to give up the Cowboys. Now, she said, I don't care what happens. She said, you don't understand me. She said, I'm a loyal person. And they've always been my team, and I'm not going to give them up. See? Well, I just tell you, that was really her. That was really her. Whatever cause she espoused. Now, Cowboys is not a big deal. Doesn't make any difference whether you root for them or Pittsburgh. They're both on the same level. See, I can say that because I've always been a Cowboy fan. Football doesn't make any difference. But that was her. That was her disposition. Was in that way, totally loyal. And people have asked me, you know, about her loyalty to Christ, why she was so stable, why she never had any ups and downs, why she was firm, why there was no problems and so forth. It was just loyal. She never one time in all of her life, regardless of any problem or any temptation, never one time, whether it was big money, and she's had opportunity to have some big money, never any time did she ever even begin to think about setting down to start to think about whether she would even back off serving Christ. It was just like that. So I look at her in that way as just totally loyal to her family, to her Lord, to whatever cause that it was. She was dignified. I see that, I've always known it, but I see it more now. That's the word that people write me from across the country and say when I think of her as dignified or a queenly type individual, that she never stooped to the depths that I do in teasing people, in just being a common, ordinary fella, I guess. She was always a dignified individual. Spiritual is another word that always comes to her mind. Spirituality was always number one in our home. With the children and with me, with everybody, the spiritual comes first and the material comes second, and it's just in that order. It's just the way it is, and so it's something that was never discussed in our home, never even brought up. The spiritual was going to come first. Another thing about her was insight. She had tremendous insight into people. She could meet people one time, and this has happened 100 times in my life, that meet somebody and I would be impressed with them, and going home I'd say, you know, that person really impressed me. And she'd say, you better watch out. I said, what do you mean? I mean, that person really a nice person. She said, I'm not saying that, I'm just going to tell you, you better watch out or you're going to get hurt. And so I'd watch out, and I don't ever know of her being wrong. In that she just had an insight into people. You don't know how many times those of you in this audience that I've talked to about your problems, that I've gone home and picked her mind, and she didn't even know I was doing it, maybe talking to somebody, and I go home and just sit down, you know, and watching football or something, and I say, I'm supposed to meet with so-and-so tomorrow, and you know, I've been watching them lately, it seems like they have everything all put together now. And she'd say, honey. I'd say, what? And she'd say, well, that person has this and this and this and this. So the next day I'd meet with you in there, and I'd say, now your problem is this and this and this and this. And you'd go away and say, boy, Lowell, really. Man, that guy able to read my mind. And you can see why I've lost my self-esteem and why I feel like that there's nothing left. I used her quite a lot like that. And I'd use her in such a way that she really didn't even know it. Another thing is femininity, that that was her goal. She wanted to be a woman. One of the things that she said in the last part of her life, I guess in the last month of her life, as we were talking, I don't even know how it was brought up, but I remember her saying, well, I like to look like a woman. No, that's it. I like to look like a woman. Whether I'm home, wherever I am, I like to look like a woman. And I think that it was when she was talking, maybe we were talking about in her class, trying to get some of the younger ladies who have been raised on blue jeans and so forth, and just your common ordinary dress. She's trying to change some attitudes. And that was her goal, that she just liked to look like a woman. When I think about her, I think of family, truly devoted to her family. Never a time did you ever doubt that her family didn't come first. And she was, in my mind, an example of Proverbs 31. The next thing is that she was always the same, whether she was with the rich or the poor. It didn't make any difference. And she associated with both of them. We've been places out holding meetings many times. We've had a lot of rough times out there, and we've had a lot of good times out there. We've been dined by the filthy rich in high places, and in the one I'm thinking of now. I tell you, it's an awful high place, but the food's no good. it's just a ticket that is really high. But when she was there, she didn't change. She didn't put on anything like that. That's where she would rely on me tremendously when we were like this. Not been too long ago that we were taken out to a place. The tab came out to $172 that these people had. It was for a few of us that were there. And the only reason I know that is they joked when they brought the back and said, just give it to him down there. And so the waitress gave it to me, and I choked, and then they picked it up and paid for it. But when we got out of there and went home, she said, honey, said, was I right? Said, did we eat with the big shots tonight? Yeah, said they were the big ones. They were the elite. But when she was with them, there was no change. There was there was no put on. She just kind of sat back, snuggle over a little bit closer to me, and have me to carry the conversation. And it didn't take them long to know that I'm not a big shot. And so they come down, and we had a good time. But you could depend on her. Whatever you saw here is what she was at home, and she was just stable in that way. Another thing, some remarks that she's made and some that I've just found out lately, I'll give to you here. Some of them are, it really caused you to wonder about, did she have a premonition that she was going to die? From some of the things she said, I think she did. Now, I've told you some of these remarks, and so I'm going to go over them pretty rapidly here again tonight. But as I've told you, I've been thinking about my death for about 5 years, and I think about it every day, and it's been fun. There's no morbid idea about it at all. It's one of the most exciting things of my life, I think, if you would ask me, is that one day I will get to take that angelic trip to heaven. That's my next biggie that I'm looking forward to. No more fishing poles. Oh, I'll get some new fishing poles. I know that. But I remember the time of when the biggest thing in my life was a fishing pole. And I remember a time when the biggest thing in my life was buying a coonhound. And the biggest thing in my life was getting that Volkswagen or that car and so forth. Now the biggest thing in my life is when that day comes when I can take that journey. When you hit a certain age, you begin to think of it, and I'm just saying this for young people, don't feel sorry for me. Roy thinks the same thing. Steve's been thinking the same thing. We didn't even know we were thinking the same thoughts until one day, I think Doris told on me. He said, "You can't believe Lowell." Said, "He'll drive along, and every time he sees a leaf fall," said, "he acts like it's Roy or Steve or somebody." He said, "Hey, did you see old Roy fall, you know, from that tree?" And then I'd give her a little speech. I'd say, "You know, mankind is just like leaves on that tree. Every leaf is going to fall in the next 60 days. Every person in this generation is going to die in just the next few years. There's a leaf down and the others are up there. Wonder who that leaf is. Who will be the first one to go?" Little did I know it would be her. And she didn't understand that. She'd just kind of look at me and I'd say, "Well, you're just a young little thing. You don't understand things like that. When you get as old as I am, well, you'll understand it." And we'd joke back and forth like that. And she never thought about her death until this summer. She got to thinking some about it. And within about a month before she died, one night I went home from class and she made a statement. She said, "You know, I'm beginning to understand what you mean when you talk about death." And I looked over at her. We didn't have a big conversation. I just said, well, I tell you what, I said, "You ain't seen nothing yet. In the next 3 years, you're going to learn a whole lot." See, in the next 3 years. And end of conversation, and we went on talking about something else. I told you then about what she told me. This was the Thursday night before she died. When I went home, it would have been the Thursday night before she got sick. She died on a Friday night. So Thursday night, she said this. Then the next Tuesday is when I took her into emergency on there. But it's when she told me that time, in a very, very definite way, she said, "Honey, this is the best time in our life for me to die." And that shocked me. It just shocked me because she never talked about death like that before. We'd always bring up death. Either I talked about it seriously, or she would bring it up rather jokingly when she had a pain or something, you know, why take her to the doctor, why she would look over at me and grin. She'd say, "Have you got your little black book handy?" And I'd always tease her, you know. She said, "I'll bet you've got a whole list of them in all those meetings that you've held, you know." And I'd come home on a meeting and she'd say, "Well, did you get any new phone numbers in your little black book?" And we'd tease each other like this and had a lot of fun about it. And I've told you about that. So, but this was no teasing, you know, when she brought this up. And I just looked and I told her, I said, "There's no way I could live without you. Absolutely, I could not live without you." And I said that seriously. I meant it at that time, but I didn't know what I was saying. And that's when she gave me a mama-to-son lecture. That's the way I felt when she got through She said, yes, you can. And she said, you will. And she just said, I know you. Just in those words, I know you. And she said, if I die, you will be totally devastated for a period of time. But I know you, and I know the kind of guy you are, that you'll pull yourself together, and you'll make a good life for yourself. She said, that's it. She said, you know, I think I've fallen in love again. And I thought she meant with somebody else. And I looked at her, I said, are you telling me something? You know, and she said, what? I said, is it somebody else or what? Oh, no, she said. She said, I'm talking about you. She said, I think I've fallen in love all over again. And I said, what do you mean by that? And she said, well, she said, when we met, she said, I fell madly in love with you, and said, I'm just madly in love. And then we got married and had children, and then I started giving my attention, you know, to raising children and doing this and doing that, and we've been trying to make ends meet, and finally the kids, you know, now are raised and they're gone, and she said, and we're here again, and she said, I just got that old feeling back again. Said it just come back. She said, I'm just falling madly in love all over again. And then she told me what she thought of me, and she just concluded, said, I just really feel honored being your wife. Then the Thursday night before she died, I went into the hospital. she said, honey, she said I pray that it won't happen. But if it does, she said, I prayed to God that I might have the faith of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and I'll accept it if it's God's will. At that time, I couldn't say anything. I just grinned and shook my head and sat there beside her. On Friday, when I went in to tell her what the report was of how bad it was she had to be operated on that night, well, the first thing she did, she looked up and very calmly, she said, well, honey, she said, we both have known for a long time that this day was coming. She said, but we've both been putting it off. And I've talked to you about that, but I'm glad we did, because we lived a happy 25 years not thinking about it. And then, one other thing, I've kind of got these out of order down here. I didn't have time to put them in order. One other thing she said that kind of brings up, and the reason I'm going to bring it up is Doris Powell's class and what she's going to be doing, but then I'll tell this and I'll tell that. And that is that we were in bed a couple months ago, and I said something about, what do you want to do tomorrow? And she said, oh, I don't care what you want to do. And I said, no, just whatever you want to do. I said, we always do whatever you want to do. She looked over, we do not. We do what you want to do. And I said, look, I've spent my whole life, everything I've done has just been for you. What? No. I said, yeah. I said, everything I've done, my whole life has just been spent for you. She said, well, why is it I feel like my whole life has been spent for you? I said, everything I've ever done, she said, I've just done for you. My whole life has been spent trying to please you. And I said, well, that's funny, because all I've ever lived for is just trying to please you. And we got an argument, who's trying to please each other the most? And so we ended up that night arguing about who loved whom the most before we went to sleep. Doris Powell said that really that's what her class is going to be about, is things that we used to do when we were courting that we forget to do after we get married. Just how do you make a man feel like a man? How do you make a woman feel like a woman? Just doing those things to try to bring out the best in your mate is really the thing she's talking about. Then the Tim Gerke told me just a week ago Sunday, said a strange thing had happened to him a couple weeks before she died. She came back in the foyer of the building, and she said, Tim, said, can I talk to you? And he said, why, sure. And she said, could I speak to you alone, said, up at the front? And Tim said, just scared him to death, because it was so uncharacteristic of her to do anything like that. And Tim said, what have I done? He said, I must have done something very terrible, because she's going to take me up there and really rebuke me. And he said, it just frightened him to death. And came up and sat down, and she said, Tim, she said, you've been put in charge of the taping now. And she said, I'd like I'd like to ask you to make sure that never, ever, from this time in Lowell's life, never again is there ever a blank tape. I said, make sure that there's never a blank ever set out from this time in his life. And Tim said, okay. And she repeated, said, Tim, she said, I want to impress upon you. She said, from this time in his life, please make sure there's never another blank tape. And do you understand? He said, yeah. And he said, then she repeated it three times. And got there, he said, do you understand what I'm saying, Tim? And he said, well, yeah. And she said, would you repeat it to me? And he repeated it to her. And she said, that's right, thank you. And got up and left. So many things she said that makes you wonder what kind of a what caused her to say those particular things. The last thing before we go into some of the other in the last 30 minutes is just some things that I've written down, which I would say is my philosophy of what to do, and what I've tried to do in getting over the grief, and what I think is the right thing to do. And I just hit it, and I said, if I were going to be preaching a sermon or writing a book, what chapters would I put in there? What would I do? And I just sat down and scribbled them out really fast, and here's what I put down. I'd have a chapter in the book, cry it out, talk it out, love it out, fight it out, live it out, laugh it out, and work it out. I think those things pretty well tell you what you need to do when a crisis hits. First of all, cry it out. Don't be ashamed to do it. God made man as an individual who can cry, and the tears of an individual, the tears of a man who is crying, is totally different chemically than the tears of a man who is laughing, or the tears of a man who is crying for joy. If you receive $1 million and you cry because of happiness, your relatives, your mother comes to see you and you cry because you're happy, they pull those tears, chemically analyze them, they're totally different than the tears of a mourning individual. You must cry. Another thing is talk it out. In talking, you're able to put things together. When you say things, it makes it real. When I talk with Roy, there's I have for hours on end, and told him probably 1,000 times the same thing, and tell him, Roy, she's dead and she won't be back. I'm making it just a little more real. I might not believe it, might have to tell him 500 more times, but when you say it, it helps. Love it out. Don't forget your love. Go back and think about your life. Think about the good things. And remember this, and I can see where it's going to be true. This is another thing that I would not have thought, not in 1,000 years, they would be true. But all the books say that the closer you were, the more you loved, the happier your marriage, the quicker you'll heal and get over it. And so, love it out. Think about it. Think about your good times. Next is fight it out. You're going to have a fight with yourself. You're going to want to just lie down and go to bed. That's what you're going to want to do. Just don't get up. Why get up? Why should a peanut hull get up? That's the way that you feel, see? I mean, what are you going to do? There's nothing. Why not just lay there? You're going to have to kick yourself out of bed. You're going to have to make yourself get up. You're going to have to make yourself do certain things. You're going to have to make yourself set appointments. You're going to have to make yourself do these things. You're going to have to fight yourself. You're your own worst enemy. You're going to feel sorry for yourself. It's all right to feel sorry for yourself. You've got problems. But don't feel sorry for yourself to the point that you get yourself down. Fight it out. Kick yourself. Give yourself talk. And make yourself get up and go do what you need to do. That's what I mean by fighting it out. Determine. Even though you don't feel like it, you're going to dress like it. Some of you young preachers I've talked to about dress, it's so important, just so important. I get up in the morning and I feel like pulling on the holiest pair of blue jeans I've got, putting on an old muddy pair of brogans and go lay in the rain, you know, or something. But what I do is I get up and I go to the closet and I dress in the best I have. And I say, okay, fella, when you look in the mirror, you're going to be wearing the best clothes that you can wear for the particular occasion. I even went out and bought new clothes for two or three reasons. One is just so I could have something a little bit better, look just a little bit neater in, and something to find out if I even had the ability to buy some clothes, as I've already talked about. But get up and dress. And dress like you're going to go out and that you're going to do something important. You might not do anything important, but I dress up and come in and kick my feet up on the chair and sit there. But boy, I look like I'm important when I'm sitting in there, you see, with feet up on the chair and no importance, no feeling, nothing. But at least it helps. It helps. Live it out. That is, live one day at a time. Don't live any more than one day at a time. In that one day, do what is right. Don't force it. Take all the time you need, whatever time is out there, and just make sure that today I'm going to do what is right. Today I'm going to get out of bed. I don't know what I'll do tomorrow. I may just stay in bed tomorrow and pout all day tomorrow. I haven't worried about that yet. I'm going to worry about that when I go home and set the alarm and say, okay, fella, set the alarm. Every night when I set the alarm, I say, why are you setting that alarm? You don't have to get up and go somewhere in the morning. Why are you setting that alarm? I guess it's just to try to make me feel important enough that I need to feel like I should go somewhere. I don't know. All I'm saying is do it. Do it there. Live one day at a time. What are you going to do tomorrow? I don't know. Just today, from here on, from here to now, the time I go to bed, I'm not going to do anything wrong. I'm going to be right. I'm going to serve God. I'm going to do the best I can. And tomorrow, we'll let it take care of itself. And I've learned that that's the only way in a time like this that you can really live. And then laugh it out. Try to use your humor. Try to see funny things in anything that happens. Learn to laugh at yourself. Look around and see. And the first time you laugh, you feel dirty. You just don't feel dirty. First time I laughed, I just felt so dirty. What was I doing? My wife is dead, and I'm laughing. I didn't want to laugh. I've not felt like laughing except just once or twice, really. I didn't want to laugh. But when I laugh, it helps me. It helps me. And I enjoy going out and when I joke with people and tease them, I don't really feel like it. I mean, if you want to do what I feel like, after class tonight, we'll go down to Sherry's and we'll talk about death, okay? That's all I've thought about all day today. That's all I've read about all day today. That's what I went to bed reading about last night. So if you want to do what I want to do, we'll go down there and we'll cry together. But go down and we'll laugh and have fun. And when I go home, I feel better. Thing, but the first time you do it, you feel dirty. Here it is, my poor wife is dead, and I'm laughing. You say, what's the cure? Well, then I talk to myself, where is she? What's she doing? She's not crying. She's not crying. She's enjoying life more than she's ever enjoyed it before, never been to bed since she died, having all those thrills, and if right now she had the choice of coming back and living or staying there, all of us know what she would want to do. What you need to do down here is use your humor. Now remember, again, God made man so he can cry, and God made man so he has humor. As far as I know, people are the only people, are the only ones who tease and laugh. Now, if God made you to laugh, there's a reason for it. Laughing, when Solomon said something about laughing, that laughter is good medicine. Laughter goes into the heart. Laughter goes into the soul. So laugh it out. And then work it out. Get busy. Get up. Make yourself have a schedule. Do good things for people. If you don't know what to do, make some kind of a schedule so that you can go out and visit somebody. Do something. Do something so when you go to bed that night, even though you feel like a peanut hull, you can examine yourself and you say, you know, I did do some good today. That's the only thing that will get you out of bed tomorrow. And as I'm saying right now, I can begin to see, literally speaking, the value of what has happened from the first day that she died, all the valuable things that have happened and all the good that's come, just from me and in talking with people and so forth in these last days. And my, oh my, how I've changed. As I said Sunday morning, the only thing about me that is the same as it was on November the 9th is just the shape of my face. I don't think the same, don't act the same, don't feel the same, nothing the same. And the wonderful thing about it, and this again is something that I would never believe, I will come out of this a better man. I will come out of it more like Christ, and I will be more effective in future days than I have in past days if I remain faithful to the Lord. If I continue on the right path, I will have more abilities to serve God in the future. I have absolutely no doubt about it whatsoever. And I'm wondering if that's not why she called Tim Gerke to the front and said, "Tim, from this day on in Lowell's life, don't you see, will you make sure there's never another blank tape?" I believe it was. What I want to do tonight now, as we'll be dealing in other lessons to a great extent, is talking now about some healing grief. What we've got up here, I just took this off of a pamphlet that's been written right there, and healing grief. Not just grief. There's a difference between a grief that heals you and a grief that doesn't heal you. Some people are grieving for years and years and years and years and years and years. But in their grief, they're not going about it in the right way. Now, when you lose a loved one, you have to grieve. Grieving is healing. That's the only way that you can possibly heal, is through your grief. So we say, well, what really happens in grief? All right, now there's three things. Now, remember, what I'm talking about now is, I'm giving you clinical studies of doctors, scientists, and all of this, where they've studied thousands of people, and they all say that there are three stages that you go through. And there's not a single human being on the face of the earth that can miss one of these stages. It cannot be done. Now, there are a lot of people who try it. But the people who try it, and they skip over it. Somebody gets out of shock. They do not go through the suffering or the grieving, a particular part of that. They just go right into rebuilding their life without any grief. You see them, they don't cry. They're sturdy, they're firm. They're the people that we brag on. Boy, they're strong. They took it. They really took it. Every one of those people, the doctors tell us, somewhere down along the line, will have some kind of a breakdown. They'll turn in, they get married again, and they turn into a wife beater. Or they lose their mind and go to a mental institution. Somewhere you're going to break down. That grief is going to come out of you. That's one thing that everybody says. Now, I can tell you from experience that I know it's true whether they say it or not. It doesn't make any difference. I know that it is going to come out of you in one way or the other. But now, you're going to go through this. Shock, suffering, and recovery. Now, as you go through it in this way, that chart doesn't really sufficiently tell you what it's all about. That's one way to analyze it. Now, I'm going to give you another way that you can analyze it, that different people try to describe it in different ways. There's a second way in which it is. All of these are going to have the same ingredients: shock, suffering, and recovery. Now, up here, the way I have it is that you suffer shock for so many days, then you go into suffering, and you suffer so many days, and then you start your recovery, then you recover. It's very simple. But it's really not like that. What happens is that you do all of these at the same time. They get all intertwined. That is, during your period of shock, you're also in a period of suffering. Your suffering right here while you're in shock is not as bad as it is when you get out of shock. And then while you're still in suffering, you start your recovery. So you're starting your recovery in there. In fact, right now on this chart, I'm somewhere right in about in here somewhere. Just getting out of the shock. I don't know how to put it. This wouldn't even do me as I look at it. I think I'm out of this. I haven't really accepted her death yet. Almost have, but haven't. But yet, I am on the road to recovery. And you say, how do you know you're on the road to recovery? Well, there's some little signposts. If you're going from here to Portland, every once in a while, you know, it says Portland, 160 miles, Portland, 98 miles, Portland, 42 miles. Now, almost anybody can understand where you are if you read those signs. Now, here is the way that they say you can tell if you recover. While you're in shock, you do what you have to do. While you're in suffering or grief, you do what people think you ought to do. You do what is the normal thing in society. How do people want me to act? Oh, they want me to be brave, okay? Your old brave Lowell. See, I'm not going to cry. I want to cry, but I'm not going to cry. People ask, how you doing, Lowell? Oh, great, great. That's what people like to hear, so that's what I say. And when I say great, I say, you liar. See, on the inside, like this. But I will act that way. I'll get up out of bed because you expect me to get up out of bed. You expect me to come to work. I don't really want to, but I will because that's what you expect. I will act the way I'm expected to act. But now they say, when you start doing things because you want to do them from your own initiative, now you've started your recovery. See? Now look at the difference. First of all, you do what you have to do. For the first period of time, I just sat and looked at the ceiling. Somebody come in, they'd say, Dad, you know, we need to go to the funeral home. Okay, get up, put on the coat, and I'd go to the funeral home. We made the arrangement. I did what I had to do. We go home, sit down. Dad, somebody's on the telephone, you know, and they'd like to talk to you. They're trying to protect me from a lot of calls and so forth, but they want to talk to you. Well, okay, I guess I have to talk. I want to talk. Hello. So I put it down. You just do what you have to do. Now, the amazing thing is you can do what you have to do in that period of time. That's the amazing thing. When you get through, you're just amazed. Now, when you suffer, you're doing what people expect you to do. But boy, the first time you do something because you want to, the first time you get out of bed and you do something because that's the way you want to do it, it's a good feeling. I've done that a couple of times. So I know that I'm on the way to recovery. I'm going to make it. There is another way to put it. Some people say it's not that simple. The chart looks more like this. And I think we're getting into reality, more like this. This up here just kind of so we can see it. Over here is your shock. Then you start going into the second phase, and you come into the third. But the reason we've got this is, going up and down is that you come into suffering, and then you go back down into shock. And then you get back up into suffering, go back down into shock. And you go suffer, shock, suffer, both at the same time. And you get over here, and finally you get much, much better, more suffering, less shock, and pow, you go down here. And just about every time you think you've got it figured out, 2 minutes later, it's opposite. You know, that's the big problem in this whole thing. That it's like an eel. You think you got it, and it just squeezes out of your hand, and you don't have it. Every time you analyze yourself. And then you're up and down, and you start recovering in here. And so it's more like that. Then another one is that more like this one down here. That all of a sudden, death comes. You're living a normal life. This is the normal realm. All of a sudden, death comes. Bang! Down it goes. It just happens like that. I mean, it happens in a millionth of a second. That's how fast it happens. There's no you don't just into it like that. It's just like that. It's the way that it hits you. I went over to the grocery store here tonight. And there's a lady that I don't know very well. I know her by face, and Roy knows her pretty well. I can't even remember her name. But I was through there, and I went up to the grocery stand, and she checked me out, and she said, how you doing? I said, oh, pretty good. And she said, it's a kick in the head, isn't it? I looked at her and said, why? She said, one of your friends went in the other day, said, I know what happened. Said, it's a kick in the head. And I said, yeah.
Yeah, I said, that's a good way of putting it. I said, I know, said, you've lost your husband. She said, yeah. She said, that's the way I put it. She said, it's if I get kicked in the head. You know, and that's a pretty good way of putting it. Only she ought to say, kicked by a horse. That's the way it is. It's just that fast. Just like a horse kicks you in the head, there you are. And you're in shock, whether you like it or not. Now then you start coming out, and you come out, and you up, and you're down, and you're up, and then all of a sudden, pow, boy, you get up here, and you think, I'm really coming out of this thing, and then pow, down here you are, and you think, I'm down lower than what I've ever been, and then you pull yourself up and down, and each time you go up and down, you're climbing just a little bit higher until you can get back up here into this recovery. Now I find that this is true. I mean, when I have it down now, when something happens and my heart just breaks, it just cuts my heart. It might be only 10 seconds. It might only be 20 seconds. Then I'm back up again, feeling good. And it didn't used to be that way. It was from morning to night, all day, 24 hours, every waking moment. You wake up during the night, whatever it is, you were down, just like that. And so, to try to analyze it, you can hardly do it. That's what I'm showing. And so people that do these studies say it's just an impossibility, really, to analyze it. Now, if you chart your feelings, about the best way I could chart them would be like this. If you're going to chart how you feel, let's suppose up there is the normal life. That's the way Doris and I were going. Just going along the normal life. All of a sudden, where that X is, they say, we lost her. Just like that. Now, just the very minute, the very moment that you notice, I told you it hit me before they even told me that, on the couch, it's just pow. I mean, you can't believe what it's like. My body was just a violent jerk and totally numb, and I was in a totally unbelievable world, and I knew I had to figure out one thing for to take her body. You can't believe how low you are. And you get down here, and then you start in. And these are the weeks, 1, 2, 3, 4 weeks. It's just kind of the way that I feel like I went. For about the first 3 weeks, there wasn't too much change. I just walked around in a daze. I just, it's hard for me to even visualize it. Like Tim said last week, I don't believe what we've been through. I just can't believe it. I'm just walking around in a daze. It seems like a dreamland of what happened. And not much change takes place. You're able to do what you need to do, but that's all that you're able to do, is just what you need to do. And then you think, boy, I'll be glad when I get out of this shock. I'll be glad when I do it. But you're not. When you get out of shock, then you go lower. And that's in grief. That's when the pain really hits. And here's what everybody points out. That when death first hits, for the first few days, you're in total shock. Total numbness. You could come out the house, you could see me. You know what I look like. A person just white as a sheet. You look like a ghost. You're gaunt. If you try to walk, you stumble. You can't think. And you're just there, and you think, the poor fella. I mean the poor guy. And you know, what can I do? How terribly bad he feels. All right. This goes on, and finally, you start coming out of that numbness. You start coming out of that numbness. And you understand, I'm alone. And then you go into grief. Now, it's at this precise moment that we Americans say, well, they pretty well got it made. They no longer stumbling around, you know, no longer have that particular look, and so got it made, and then people pull back and go back to work, and say, when they see you, they say, well, boy, you know, sure glad you're doing so great, you know, just really, really happy that you're doing great. And this really hadn't happened to me. I mean, I've had an ideal situation with relationship with you, but I can see it in few cases it's happened. But in other cases, this is just normal. And this is just when you're starting to hurt. This is just when you start to feel it. And all of the studies show the pathetic thing in America is people pull back away from a grieving person just at the time, just at the very point of where he really feels the pain. That's when people say, well, he's doing great and he doesn't need me anymore. Now, if you don't want to do anything for anybody, don't do it for the first couple of weeks. just let them lay out there in the middle of the floor. It wouldn't make too much difference where I was. You know, just, I mean, you're out of it. Now, that's an over-exaggeration. I can't tell you how much I appreciate all you people coming out. I mean, I really can't. But I'm saying if you had to have one or the other, see, if it ever happens again, you say, well, Lord, you only get one of the two. Well, then just let me lay out there for about 3 weeks, then come out. Because that's when the pain really starts, see. Then you start out of it in here in the seventh, and then I told you about that eighth week. It's just, you just, something happens in there that you really start to jump up. There's a great jump. From that eighth week, I've been kind of leveled off, and the last couple of weeks, I've been making a real good climb back out of it. I don't think I'm that close up there to that, but on the chart, I would be way down here yet to get to normal life. And they say that you never get back up there, but at least you're making a good start. Now, as we talk about this, and we talk about shock. What is shock? All right, now, shock is the best thing that can happen to you. It really is. Because what it does is that it affects your mind and your total body. Your whole body goes numb, and your whole body changes. And you do change physically. You become a sick individual physically. Your immune system totally closes down, just to give you one illustration. Your feelings are numbed, and all of a sudden you set up a denial system. You deny it. It has not happened. Now you know it's happened intellectually, but you deny it. I wake up in the morning. This thing, it'll just be a dream. No, it's not. It'll just be a dream. And you go on and on. But you set up that denial. Now that denial is good. Because if you don't deny it, if you accept it when they come in and they tell you that your loved one has died, if you didn't go into shock and you didn't set up a denial system, you would die on the spot. That is exactly what would happen. You'd die on the spot. Your body could not take it. And God, in His divine wisdom, set this up so that it filters into your mind. It hits you all of a sudden that the acceptance filters into your mind just a little bit, a little bit. It's just a constant filter every second of the day, every second. It's so imperceptible, you never know what's happening. You can't feel it. You want to see a change. You can't see a change, but it's just in there. It's just in there, and it is constant, just continue until, after a while, you have accepted it. Now, we all see things in God's wisdom. We just wonder how God could be so brilliant as to make an eye, how He could make an ear, how He could make all of these things. This is what I asked people the other day. If you'd have been making a man, if you had all the technology and you knew how to make livers and hearts and you could make a man, and you're getting ready to breathe into him the breath of life, would you have put a denial system in his mind? Now, you've got it. You've got it in your mind. Let me ask you this. Every bad thing that happens to you, regardless of how small it is, every bad thing that happens to you, you deny it. What happens if I pick up this water right here and I've got it up here like this and I'm sloshing it around? But what you say? Well, if you're not going to tell me, I'm going to hit you. What is it? If I knock this water off, what goes through your mind? First thing, knock it off. Oh, no. What am I saying? That's a denial. You don't say, oh, no, for nothing. That's a denial. It can't be true. It is. Now, with a glass of water, bang, bang, and you're over it. See? You deny it, and you see it is, and you're over it. If I take out my knife right here, and I drop my knife, and it falls down a crack, what do I say? Oh, no. It's down a crack way over there. I go over there to pull it out. Bob McCarran says, oh, you can't get it. That thing goes all the way down. That's 12 feet down. What will I do? Well, I say, oh, well, okay then. Is that what I'll do? No. I mean, you got a screwdriver, Bob? I'll take it off. I look, sure is. Man. Anybody got a string or something I can get? Anybody got a wire? What am I doing? My knife's gone. Bob says it's gone. I can't get it. What am I doing? I'm denying it. I want that knife back. So, with a knife, I'll try, I can't get it. Okay, what's the knife? It's gone. Now I've accepted it. Now I'm on the road to recovery. See, I go buy me a new knife. If I drop my knife, it is shock, denial, grief, I'm sorry, recovery. If I drop a penny down there, I put a line, and a penny falls down. Oh no, I'm over. See, for a penny, it takes half a second. For a knife, it takes a couple minutes. For a wife, do you see the difference?
Now you've got it built in you. If you ever said, oh no, you go home, what happens? You go home and the roast is burnt. What do you say? When you walk in the door, you smell it. Everybody, what do you say? Oh no, can't be. You go in and look. Oh no!
Happened to us not very long ago. I got the fork, got down, there's any meat in the middle. Yeah, there's meat in the middle, honey. And I got the meat out and tasted it.
Just terrible. And finally, I got over it. See, I went through my grief, $12 down the drain, threw it in the wastebasket, and I've recovered now from the roast beef. We all go through this all the time. All right, now what happens? Whether you're an alien sinner or whether you're a Christian, it happens to you that way. You're going to suffer. You're going to go through this. Now, being a Christian helps you recover tremendously. All the studies show that faith in God helps you recover tremendously. But there's a lot of things that Christians try to cover up. Homer Haley, who lost his wife when he was about my age, he's 80-some years old now, he called me the next morning, and he said, Lowell, you know, I asked him, he said, Homer, have you got any advice for me? You know, I don't know. Said, anything you can tell me that will help me? He said, Lowell, he said, when people tell you that you're a Christian, they're going to tell you that the Lord will replace her. You're a Christian, and the Lord will replace her. He said, don't you believe it for a minute. The Lord doesn't replace your wife. And he said, he's not going to take her place either. He's not going to take her place. The Lord wasn't meant to take her place. He said, the Lord gave you a wife, and he serves the wife, and the Lord's not going to do it, and you're going to hurt. He said, don't you ever believe anybody comes up and tells you all that nonsense. Now, he told me that the very next morning, real early, when I got out of bed. And he said it very firmly. But I could tell he had been told that a lot, and I could tell that he was a man that understood. No, there's a place for the Lord, but the Lord's not my wife, and the Lord intends for me to go through grief. Now, while you're in shock, it all seems like a dream. It's just a dream. You just can't believe it. I called the family together immediately. As I've told you, I really don't know what all I said. I do know three things that came to my mind I wanted to tell them immediately. And that is, I told them, I said in the words of Job, Jehovah is given and Jehovah is taken away. And blessed be the name of Jehovah. That we've had many good years with her. It hurt. But God knows what he's doing. I said, number two, I want you kids to know that right now that your families will be endangered. I can get in your way and you'll try to protect me. And I don't want to divide your family. I want your family to stay together. There's certain things I'm going to have to do, and I'm going to have to do it alone. And I want you with me. I want us to work this thing out together. But I want you to understand that you're going to have to keep your family together. Number three, I said, Mom and I now have parted. Our family's broken. And each one of us has always tried to keep our name honorable so that any time our name was mentioned, people would remember it with honor. I said, I want you to remember that. And when it comes your time to pass over, that you pass that name on to your children and you keep that name an honorable name. Other than that, I don't know what I said. That night, I couldn't view her body. They asked the family if they wanted to come in. My children went in to view her body, and you can ask them whether they would advise you to do that or not. I did not experience it. I don't know. My feeling was that if I had one more burden placed on me, I'd totally collapse. I could not do it that night, or I'd have died, is the way I felt. So I didn't. To show you the way the mind works, we'd been on the second floor all evening with Doris. They took her down to the operating room on the first floor, so we went down to the waiting room. After she died, we went back up to the second floor, and that's where we were when everybody came over to see us. for some reason, I needed to go back down to the first floor. I have no idea what it was for. I don't know whether I forgot something, had to get some. I have no idea. But anyway, I told him, I said, I need to step down to the first floor from the second floor, and I'll just jump down. I'll be right back. So I jumped in the elevator, went to the first floor, picked up whatever it was, got back in the elevator, and I said, now, where were I? Where was I? I've been on the second floor all evening. Where was I? What button do I punch? I stood there and looked at that, and I don't remember. I believe it was the fourth floor. And I punched the fourth floor. Went up the fourth floor, and the door opened, and nobody on the fourth floor. Boy, I said, I know it's not the fifth floor. I don't know why I didn't know it was the fifth floor, but I knew it wasn't. I'll bet it's the sixth floor. So I punched the sixth floor and went up the sixth floor. Nobody on the sixth floor. Man, I'm in trouble. I can't find the family. And I thought, now, what will I do? It's not on the fifth floor. I've been on the fourth. I'll go to the third. So I went down to the third, and I looked out there, and no family. So I punched the second, went to the second, looked out, and there they were. And so I walked out and acted like nothing happened. But that's what went on in that elevator. Now, that shows you how your mind works. You're just numb. It's hard to walk. You stumble. It's hard to think. But you can do what you need to do. You can't take care of certain things, like your bills and your letters and things that come. I literally could not open them. I just threw them at Steve and said, Steve, would you send them to the insurance company? I started to break it open, and I couldn't do it. I just felt like I'd die if I did. During this time, there's one thought that's always before you, and that is the one who died. You can never get it off of your mind for 1 second. There's not 1 second you can get it off. Now, it was in the 11th week that I started to get it off of my mind for a few minutes at a time. I could be doing something, visiting with somebody, going down to Sherry's and having a good time. And about every minute or two, I'd think of her, and I'd think, you know, I wasn't thinking of her for about a minute or two. And you get a terrible feeling then, thinking that you've deserted her. Now then, when I'm thinking of her, it doesn't hurt nearly as much. I can think of her without the pain being there. And there are a few minutes at a time when I'm talking to somebody that I don't think of her. But during that period of shock, that's what it's going to be like. Now, next week, I'm going to start giving you some quotes and readings and statistics and so forth of what studies show about the shock and the grief and the recovery. We'll talk about what it shows that actually happens to you in many, many people since you have observed it in me. We'll talk about what to do about it, what to do for a friend. We'll talk about how to prepare for this data to happen and some of these other things in the following 6 weeks. Now, are there any questions tonight? Anybody have any on any subject that comes to your mind at this time? Okay, if not, then we will close tonight. Brian, would you lead us in our closing prayer, please?